I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is writer and investigative journalist Gabriel Sherman. He's joined in conversation by UC Berkeley Professor of Investigative Reporting, Lowell Bergman. And now, join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce Gabriel Sherman and Lowell Bergman. Even before investigative journalist Gabriel Sherman's new book, The Loudest Voice in the Room, The Inside Story of How Roger Ailes and Fox News Remade American Politics, was published, it was the subject of much comment, speculation, and accusation in the press and online. Fox News fans lined up to slam the not-yet-published book. According to David Carr of the New York Times, quote, "Part of the reason Ailes and his allies have campaigned against the book is not because it is false, but because it tells a true story." Sherman chronicles the rise of Ailes, a sickly kid from an Ohio factory town who, through sheer willpower, the flair of a showman, fierce corporate politicking, and a profound understanding of the priorities of Middle America, built the most influential television news empire of our time. From the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal to the Bush-Gore recount, from the war in Iraq to the Tea Party attack on the Obama presidency, Roger Ailes has become the man any Republican politician with presidential aspirations must court. We are extremely pleased to have investigative journalist Lowell Bergman here tonight to interview Gabriel Sherman. Lowell Bergman is a producer and correspondent for the PBS documentary series Frontline. In 2004, he received the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service, awarded to the New York Times for A Dangerous Business, which detailed a foundry company's egregious worker safety and environmental violations. His 60 Minutes investigation of the tobacco industry was dramatized in the Academy Award-nominated feature film The Insider. He's the Reva and David Logan Distinguished Professor of Investigative Reporting at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, where he has taught a seminar dedicated to investigative reporting for more than 20 years. Please join me in welcoming Gabriel Sherman and Lowell Bergman to the JCCSF.
Okay. Well, as you can tell from the introduction, I've been in this business for a long time. Almost 40 years. And so when I was reading your book, the first thing that came to my mind was, why are you doing this?
Good question.
And particularly because the central character doesn't want to talk to you and is a man of means and experience in the media business and simply would deny himself to you. Mm-hmm. And maybe you could explain what your motivation was and why you think it was worth all that time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just wanted to thank Lowell for doing this. I followed his work. He's a legend in my business, our business, so I'm just so thrilled to be here. I felt that everyone in America has an opinion about Fox News, whether you love the channel or you hate it. But what we didn't have as a culture is a lot of facts. How does it work? How is it created? What is Roger Ailes is the founder's influence on American politics? Why does Fox News generate $1 billion of profit? Why does it have twice the audience that CNN and MSNBC do? So these are just the basic reporters' questions. How, why, where, who, and what? And maybe naively, I thought I could go out, try to talk to everybody, consult documents, archival material, and just tell a measured and nuanced story about this phenomenon in American media and politics. Now, what I didn't realize is that by going out to report this book, I would be transformed into a political target by the right, and the process and the adversarial relationship I had with my subject would be almost as revealing as the facts that I learned along the way.
Well, I've tried to report myself on Rupert Murdoch's operations in general, and Fox News in particular, in attempt to get people to talk. And one of the things that I noticed was the extreme discipline. Mm-hmm. Did you just, what was your reaction when you ran up against this discipline? And did you have second thoughts about whether or not you actually had a story?
Yeah. I mean, that was the omerta that exists in the Murdoch world in general. And then the Fox News world in particular. You know, Fox News is a division of Rupert Murdoch's media empire. It's actually a little bit different than his newspapers because Roger Ailes, through his corporate power and his profits, has carved out complete independence to run his fiefdom as he sees fit. So Rupert Murdoch gives Roger Ailes a wide latitude to run Fox News. And the one thing that Roger Ailes prizes more than anything is loyalty. You know, one of my sources I interviewed compared Ailes to the Hyman Roth character in The Godfather 2, who's known in the film as the man from Miami. And this person who was in all the meetings, he's in the inner circle, he said, you know, Roger Ailes is the man from Fox News. The people in the building can't say his name. You're not supposed to talk about him. If he issues orders to producers to do some piece of right-wing programming, they're not allowed to say, oh, Roger Ailes told me to do this. They have a saying in the office that when Ailes wants something done, they say, the second floor says, or the second floor wants. And the second floor is a reference to his executive suite on the second floor of the News Corporation headquarters in Manhattan. So it's this extreme secrecy, the secrecy culture that he's created, which in many ways is antithetical to journalism. I mean, journalism is about transparency. It's about the free flow of ideas and debate. But his culture is a secrecy culture. And so it just required persistence. It's one of the reasons this book took 3 years to do.
Well, is it possible that at least in my experience, the one thing about journalists is that we all talk too much.
Mm-hmm.
And we love to gossip and we love to complain. So is it possible, as some of the characters in your book say, they are loyal to Roger Ailes.
Yeah.
They do like working for him.
Yes.
He is a charismatic character.
100%.
And takes care of his people.
Yes. If you're in the family, they refer to Fox News as a family, he can shine a light on you and transform your life. You know, some of the anchors on Fox News, the people that we all know, Sean Hannity, Shepard Smith, Bill O'Reilly. When Roger Ailes started Fox News in 1996, he hired a bunch of second-rate, washed-up, faded personalities. Bill O'Reilly was essentially out of work. Sean Hannity was a talk radio show host in Atlanta, did not have a national following. And Ailes created these personalities and made them rich beyond their wildest dreams. I mean, they are multimillionaires many times over. And as I learned in the reporting of this book, money is a powerful inducement to being loyal. And the money and the profits that Fox generates makes the stakes of stepping out of line and leaving that family so extreme. And in Ailes' world, there's no gray area. You can't have a disagreement or a difference of opinion and expect to remain in the inner circle. The minute he senses that you are not fully on board with him, you're out. And he casts you out with a ruthlessness that was quite shocking to learn.
So let me take you back for a minute. You say at the outset of your book, it's on the cover, he's the man who divided a country. But he's just an executive in a multinational corporation. He's not Rupert Murdoch. He depends on Rupert Murdoch, right, for his financial backing and mm-hmm. for his support. So isn't he just a functionary of the media business as it is now?
Mm-hmm. He could have been, but he's so much more. You know, what I find so interesting about Ailes is he is a once-in-a-generation character for his business who understands the power of media to transmit a message. It's important to step back and sort of put Ailes' career into context, which shows how he's much more than just an executive. His formative political experience was as a television advisor to Richard Nixon in 1968. He was the TV consultant who made sure whenever Nixon was on camera that the lighting was good, the staging, the makeup, all the technical aspects of Nixon's TV campaign in 68, which, as many people know, that was the campaign that was Nixon's comeback, because in 1960, in the famous debates against John Kennedy, he appeared ghostly and sweaty on camera. And then in 68, he appeared warm and human, almost like a talk show host. So it was a radical transformation. But what Ailes learned working for Nixon in 68 was the grievances and the frustrations and the wedge politics of the culture wars that would persist throughout the 70s, the 80s. These were the Reagan Democrats. These were the culture warriors who fought Bill Clinton in the 90s. And then ultimately, the way our country responded to terrorism and 9/11, this us versus the world mentality. And Ailes knew how to program political attack lines that resonated and split the culture and ultimately cleaved our media culture. I mean, MSNBC now is essentially trying to be a progressive analog and a counterweight to Fox News. Our media culture now has been split, whether you're on the right or the left, and that's a testament to Ailes' success.
One of the things you don't get into in the book in any detail is the way the landscape changed in terms of, for instance, in broadcast news. We lost in 1987 the fairness doctrine, or the right of reply. I'm not sure anybody remembers it, but there was a time when you couldn't say things that Rush Limbaugh says or Fox says every day without giving people equal time to reply. So he's fitting perfectly into that new new world and taking advantage of it. What's the matter with that?
Oh, there's nothing. This book is not in any way an attack on Ailes, and in many ways it's a testament to his power. Now, that said, what I find pernicious about Fox is the subterfuge that they employ to essentially deceive their audience. It's the fair. I mean, it all goes back to the fair and balanced slogan, that the power of Fox to be a political organ depends on the audience believing that it's real news. When if Ailes was transparent and said, oh, well, I'm in the politics business, I've always been in the politics business since 1968, and I have a TV channel that's trying to program Republican TV, I don't think we would even be having this conversation. I think what is so transformational about Fox is that he has essentially convinced people that news, what they're getting is news when they're getting politics. And now you cannot have a conversation about the news business without immediately having a political conversation. Well, which side are you on? Are you biased? Oh, is this a plot to cover up for Hillary Clinton? I mean, this is every news story now is infused with a political debate. And that, again, is a result of the way Fox has transformed the business.
So in doing this three-year project, right, where this person won't talk to you, where this discipline has been enforced, you report that you interviewed 600 and how many people?
614
people. Many of them unnamed.
Many and named, though, too.
I understand. But 25 instances in the first part of your book, people who are described as author interview with a person familiar with the matter, author interview with a person close to Roger Ailes, author interview with a national Republican official. These are all real people?
Yeah, very real.
Why did they put themselves at risk?
Well, I think one of the challenges of this book was to understand sources' motivations, and you you wrestle with that in your work every day. Some sources were self-interested. I mean, all sources are self-interested. Some wanted to get back at Roger Ailes. Some wanted to defend him. The sources I found to be the most valuable were the ones who realized that they had worked with a man who had played a role in American history, and they felt like they wanted a real book written about him. I mean, so much of the journalism and the media coverage of Roger Ailes is through a partisan filter. You have people on the left attacking Fox News. You have people on the right lionizing Fox News. But there hasn't been, until now, a deep and probing look at it as just a story. So I really valued the sources who, with good intentions, said, I've worked with this man who redefined his industry, and I want you as the reporter to understand him. And it was those sources I found who were the most revelatory, including his own brother.
I was going to ask you about his brother, but his brother is on the record.
On the record.
So how did that happen? He couldn't control his brother?
Roger Ailes can control everything in the world except his brother. No, I... It was a really, you know, you have moments, I have moments as a reporter where you are just struck by good fortune. And, you know, I was about a year into the reporting of this book. I had gone down many dead ends. People had come forward, but it was, I was just really banging my head against the wall. And I was in Warren, Ohio, which is where Roger Ailes grew up. It's a factory town in northeast Ohio. In his time, when he was born in 1940, it was a booming factory town. The factories were churning out cars and products. But now it's a wasteland. It's sort of a story of American decline. And I was in Warren, Ohio, and I went to the house where Roger Ailes grew up. And I was back in my hotel room, and I said, well, now I want to call his brother. I'd been meaning to call the family. I hadn't yet reached out to the family. And I said, well, I'm in their hometown. And I called his, looked in the phone book, and his brother lives in Florida, and I called him up. And I was expecting him to slam the phone down, as many people had done to me prior to that. And we just started talking, and I said, I'm Gabe Sherman. I'm working on a biography of your brother, Roger Ailes. I would love to talk with you about what it was like to grow up in Warren, Ohio. And in fact, I'm in Warren, Ohio. And he said, you know, in the 20 or 30 plus years my brother has been a famous person, not one reporter has called me. And I don't know if that's true or not, but he almost seemed like he was eager to share his story about what it was like growing up with Ailes and who his brother was as a young man. And so we started talking, and you know, after a little while, he said the dreaded words, well, I really should check with Roger about this. And that's the words you never want to hear as a reporter, because you know that the principal is going to tell the surrogate, you know, just don't cooperate. So I said, okay, of course, you know, he knows I'm doing the book. Please call him, and I'll, you know, let's talk later this week. So a day or so later, I call him back, and I said, his name is Robert Ailes. I said, Robert, I would love to reconnect. Have you talked to Roger? What has he said? So, well, Roger says I really shouldn't be talking to you. And I said, oh, that's too bad. And I'm expecting the conversation to fizzle out. And I said, oh, but I just want to ask you a couple of things about, you know, Warren, Ohio. And we start talking. And before I know it, another hour has passed. And he just keeps going and going. And then periodically over the 2+ years after that I was doing the book, I had 7 interviews with him. Because every time I had a question about their family history or their genealogy, I would call Robert Ailes. And he was very patient. I'm incredibly grateful to his patience. And he really wanted me to understand what his family's history was like. And the great thing that I found as a reporter was that Robert Ailes wanted to share his family history. He had written an unpublished memoir. He had studied the Ailes family genealogy traced back to 17th century Wales in England where they came from. So he was as interested in this story as I was. And so it was just this incredible moment of good luck that I had.
Has he called you since the book came out?
I have not heard from him. I've been meaning to call him. He did. A Washington Post reporter called him to ask that very question. And he said, he basically laughed it off and said, well, I didn't know Gabe Sherman from George Washington, which essentially sounds like a line Roger Ailes probably fed him. But he basically tried to say, oh, well, I didn't really know what I was doing, but then didn't elaborate. So he didn't walk back anything he told me.
But you don't know what he went through afterwards.
No, I do not. But we know he's still alive, so it's half the battle.
Well, there is in a reading of your book, there is this sense of ominous power. That's why I ask. Mm-hmm. You know, what are people afraid of? Mm-hmm.
A lot of my interviews were like therapy sessions. I was trying to draw sources out because the fear, you know, these are grown men, many of them making 6- and 7-figure salaries, and they speak of dealing with Ailes as if their life will be in danger. You know, I write about an episode in the book, which maybe we can get to, about Ailes' brief tenure at NBC. Before he started Fox News in 1996, he spent a little over 2 years as an executive at NBC running CNBC, the business channel. And it was a tumultuous period. He was in these vicious corporate feuds with other NBC executives. And these men who were, you know, no wilting flowers in their own right, describe like fearing for their lives, fearing for their family safety, fearing that Ailes could become physically violent with them. And I, you know, it also is important to note he has episodes of violence. In the 80s, when he was a political consultant working for Rudy Giuliani, he beat up a gay activist, a protester at a fundraiser. And the activist was taken to the hospital, thought about pressing assault charges. Roger Ailes carries a concealed handgun. He's one of the few people in Manhattan who it's very difficult to get a license in New York City to carry a concealed handgun. He's one of the few that has it. So he projects this menacing quality. But it's almost like a psychological violence that he inflicts on people. It's the fear, the emotional fear. Because again, he is just a TV executive. He works for a multinational company. He's not a man that you would think would, he's not a gangster. I mean, he works for a public company. So it's telling that these people who work with him fear for their livelihoods.
But that's what they fear for.
For their jobs. Yeah. I think that's what it boils down to.
You're listening to investigative journalist Gabriel Sherman, whose new book is The Loudest Voice in the Room, the inside story of how Roger Ailes and Fox News remade American politics. He's joined in conversation by Lowell Bergman on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
The other thing I came away from with the book was that that I wanted to ask you about is you give Fox News and Ailes, in a sense, all this credit, this power behind the U.S. invasion of Iraq. But I remember that I was at the New York Times at that mm-hmm. time. I was at Frontline at that time. I have multiple employers given my employment history. And there were any number of people, mm-hmm. Tom Friedman, Ted Koppel, the list goes on, who were either riding along in tanks or saying this was a good idea. Mm-hmm. So is it really Fox News that did this, or was it the media, or was it all of us, if you will?
Well, one of Ailes' greatest talents is getting other people to do his work for him.
You think he manipulated everybody?
So I get into this episode deep into the book because I got fascinated by at sort of transformational moments in Fox's history over since 96. And one of those moments was in the months and years after 9/11. And I went back and I watched the coverage of how Fox News covered the day of September 11th, the day the attacks happened. And what was eerie and uncanny and almost scary all these years later is you see the rhetoric of the post 9/11 years, the us versus the world, the hyper patriotism, the demonization of any dissent, in the literally the hours after the towers came down, you had people going on Fox News, people like Newt Gingrich, saying this is going to require a total American response, and if anyone wavers, you know, there you have to be with us or against us. You had Bill O'Reilly in the months and years after 9/11 saying anyone who's not on board with the invasion of Iraq will be considered an enemy of the state by me. So it was this hyper-patriotism style of programming that Fox pushed that essentially set the tone for the rest of the media to follow. And I interviewed officials in the Bush White House who told me that Fox News silenced any isolationist voices on the right, the kind of paleoconservatives, the Pat Buchanans, the Brent Scowcrofts, big national Republicans who were trying to voice caution about rushing to war with an enemy who now we know had nothing to do with 9/11. Fox News pushed the neoconservative line, which was that we have to hit back, we have to show the world who's boss. And so what that allowed the Bush administration to do is they didn't need to worry about their right flank. They could sell the war to the middle. And they found people like Judith Miller at the New York Times. They found people in the mainstream who got on board with this idea that Saddam Hussein had a trove of weapons of mass destruction. And so Fox created the media climate that allowed the rest of the media to fall into line. And that's really what the reporting in my book shows. And that, to me, is again to this the point about how Ailes divided the country, is that he created a media force that was so powerful that he caused other media organizations to change their tone and to either follow him or now in recent years they've been opposing him.
But you yourself write in the book mm-hmm. that his calculation in terms of where the country's going and who is the United States mm-hmm. of America is wrong. Mm-hmm. And that's undermining his economic base mm-hmm. at Fox in general and potentially his future.
It's in some ways why I consider Ailes a tragic character, because he's ultimately causing his own demise, because he sees himself now and Fox News as a way to save the republic, to save the America that he knew as a boy growing up in 1940s and 50s in Warren, Ohio. And yet that America probably never existed and certainly doesn't exist now. And so he's speaking to a smaller and smaller group of viewers who want that style of programming, which is, like you mentioned, is ultimately undermining the very business model that made him so powerful.
He's basically after the white male,
yes,
geriatric like me.
Now they're geriatric. When he was through his career, they were at one point not old.
That is true. Joke. By the way, has Roger Ailes done anything good?
Yes. That's why he's a very compelling character. You know, that was the other thing.
Like what?
Incredibly generous. He uses philanthropy and charity as another way of expressing his worldview. He is incredibly generous with our military. His entire life, he wanted to be in the military. He tried to register for the Air Force, but something that most people may not know is he's a hemophiliac, and his medical condition kept him out of the military. But that did not end his romance with the military, so he gives generously to kind of wounded warrior-type charities. He's been very generous in his hometown of Garrison, New York. Now, that charity has come with some strings attached, but one of the recurring themes that his loyalists tell me is that when you are in his family, he's paid for serious medical surgeries for people who've fallen on hard times, employees. There was a woman who worked for him whose dream was to go to makeup school. I think she was a janitor at Fox News, and she mentioned one day that she wanted to go to makeup school. He paid for it out of his own pocket. So he has this incredible charitable streak to him. But what I learned in the course of my reporting is that generosity and charity is also a form of power.
So what has he done that's good?
Well, if you're in his team, he's taking care of you.
Okay. You know, often when I get a fat book to read, the first thing I do is go back and read the back of the book first. And I recommend everybody go to page 401 when they buy this book after the event. You met Roger Ailes.
Mm-hmm.
You talked with him.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like, and why is it the end of the book?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me answer the first question, and then maybe you'll get to the second point. So I, for 2 years, had been reporting, trying to talk to Ailes. He knew basically where I was. You know, the way journalism works is you interview someone, especially if they're close to the principal, they report back to Ailes or whoever your subject is about what you're up to. But he was reluctant to sit down with me, declined to sit down with me. So then my strategy was, well, I really want to make my pitch to him in person. I'd written him letters, talked to his lawyers. And so I found out that he was going to be at a public event at the Four Seasons restaurant in Manhattan. That was open to the media. He was being celebrated as a media titan by the Hollywood Reporter magazine. Ironic that a conservative is being celebrated by the liberals in Hollywood. So I got on the list to attend the event. And I went in, and it's a big atrium-like space. And I went in with my notebook and my tape recorder and approached him. And it was this incredible moment because while it was only an exchange that lasted several minutes, it was freighted with so much emotion. He called me a harasser. He also called me a good reporter, so I don't know how those things square. But he said that because of him, I'm allowed to write this book, that he's single-handedly defending the First Amendment. He said, why did you go back to Warren, Ohio? No one there knows me. It was almost like he was felt incredibly threatened that a reporter was out there trying to write about him and tell his story. And I found it very revealing because the way a subject acts in the moment told me almost as much as he may have said in the course of a sit-down interview, because it was his body language and also the way he engaged with me. He told me that Barbara Walters, who was at this party, that I had been trying to talk to her, and he said, well, you know, Barbara Walters will now speak to you. And I said, that's wonderful. I've been trying to for months. And he said, well, you don't want to talk to her because she'll only say nice things about me. And I said, well, that's ridiculous because I've been trying to talk to her for for months. And it was this idea that he felt like he talked as if I had to be the enemy, which fit his his MO and his worldview that journalists are the enemy, that I couldn't be someone who was actually just trying to document his story and his career. Now, to your question about why that was in the end of the book, throughout this entire process, I did not want to be a character in the story. I wanted this book to be a work of reported history. I wanted it to hold up over time. I did not want it to be a quest narrative of my journey in, you know, search of the truth about Roger Ailes, because Ailes is the subject, and I wanted it to be a detached kind of third-person narrative. So I felt, well, how is it? How can I share part of my process, part of my experience with readers in a way that doesn't shift the spotlight onto me? And the way I did that was having a note on sources that open up the more than 100 pages of endnotes, which is a, you know, an essay that sketches out the process and what it was like to take on this adversarial assignment.
Well, I understand when you start a project where you want to start. And when you started out, you had some hope, according to the endnotes, mm-hmm. Or this essay,
yeah.
That you were going to be able to interview him. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yes.
You met with his lawyers, right?
Yep. I sat down with his people from the moment I got my book contract, to be totally transparent. This is happening. I want you to participate, but it's going to happen either way.
But you knew after a while it wasn't going to happen. Although you've been criticized in some of the reviews that Ailes is pretty accessible.
Well, Ailes is incredibly accessible to reporters. But the conditions upon which he imposes the style of interview, the ground rules were such that I could never write this book if I wanted Ailes to cooperate. For an example, very early on, his PR advisor said to me, well, before Roger Ailes even thinks about sitting down with you, you have to agree to not use any sources on background that could say anything that Roger Ailes could construe as negative. That if anyone wants to say anything that Roger Ailes won't like, they have to attach their name to it. Now, this is a man who has a career of seeking retribution and attacking enemies. And so in all good conscience, while I want sources to be on the record, I couldn't put sources, guarantee that kind of ground rule to put people in jeopardy. So I dismissed that offer out of hand. But that's the kind of conditions upon which Ailes puts reporters to get access.
And you ran into him in Washington.
Yes, I ran into... So another.
And
this
his
was,
son made you, right?
Yes, so I did the one more attempt to get Ailes to cooperate. This was in the summer of 2013. He was being honored at the Kennedy Center at a gala in Washington, D.C. Once again, I got on the press list to attend. And I walk into the cocktail hour, the reception before this award ceremony. And a very nice young man who looks like a college Republican in his, what I thought, in his late teens, early 20s, meets me at the front door. And I said, oh, I'm looking for the reception. And this young man says, oh, well, I'll show you in. Very friendly, very warm. And we start walking down this long corridor. And he asked me what I'm doing. I said, oh, I'm a reporter from New York City. And he said, oh, well, what's your name? And I said, oh, I'm Gabe Sherman. I'm writing a book about Roger Ailes. And instantly his demeanor changed. And this young man turned from very warm to very chilly, and I noticed he started to pick up his pace. So then I pick up my pace. And before I know it, we're speed walking down this corridor together. And before I said, well, what's your name? And before he could answer, he spills out into the reception hall. And I watch him from a distance, and he slaloms through the crowd, and he makes his way through this giant crowd. And my gaze follows him, and I see him approach Roger Ailes. And so then I'm like, this is kind of curious. And they huddle together. And I kind of position myself where I know Ailes is going to have to walk by me to make it to the award ceremony. And as he approaches with the young man and his and Ailes' bodyguard, I say, Mr. Ailes, I'd love to speak with you. Can I talk with you after the event? And before he can answer, his bodyguard pushes me out of the way. And I'm knocked off balance, and I kind of am jostled and trying to get my bearings. And then, you know, by this point, Ailes is about 5 minutes ahead. And he swivels around, and he says, I don't mean to be rude, but this is a family night. And I'm thinking to myself, family night, like, isn't that when you order takeout and watch a movie? And then he turns to the young man and he says, Zachary, go find your mother. So it turned out that the young man is his son, Zachary Ailes, who is Ailes' only son. Ailes had him when he was 60 years old, and he's kind of one of the other reasons why Ailes sees it as his mission to save America, because he's worried about what his son is going to, you know, experience and what the country will be like after Ailes goes, and what what his son will have to face.
By the way, did Barbara Walters ever talk to you?
She did, and her comments are duly represented in the book.
Okay. So Ailes thinks you were harassing him. But what have been the consequences for you? You were telling me before, as we were walking in, private investigators following you around?
It was this was an eye-opening experience as a reporter. I know you've, I'm sure, experienced this throughout your career. This was my first brush with raw corporate power. I've covered Wall Street banks. I've written about big media companies. I've never experienced both the public aspects and the secretive aspects of being the target of a very powerful man. So Ailes' strategy to deal with me was two-pronged. The first thing was to define me in the eyes of his audience as a left-wing activist. They smeared me on websites, right-wing conservative websites, ran articles about me. The website Breitbart News, which was founded by the conservative activist Andrew Breitbart, published more than 9,000 words about me, calling me Jason Blair on steroids, which is a reference to the disgraced New York Times reporter. Another article called me a George Soros attack dog because I have a fellowship at a foundation that receives a minuscule portion of its funding from one of Soros' charities. So I think in Ailes' mind, he wanted to define me as a left-winger so that his conservative audience wouldn't take the book seriously. But the second thing he did, which I learned, which is that in the summer of 2012, they had private investigators follow me. Now, I never saw these men, but I had a confidant very close to Ailes tell me that he hired PIs to follow me around. And I knew that Ailes has done this. He's done this with his employees. He's done this early in his career. And in my first meeting with Ailes' confidant, with his PR advisors, I said, this was in the winter of 2011, I said, well, if you guys are going to play ball, you're going to play dirty, good luck. Because I'm a pretty boring guy, and thinking now about what it was like for this PI to sit out wherever he was staking me out, it must have been the most boring, soul-crushing assignment of his career. Oh, there he's going jogging again. Oh, he's getting his coffee. I mean, no strip clubs, no drugs for me. I mean, I live a pretty staid life.
Pure. So, would you have done this again if you know now what you were going to go through to do this story?
Depends on what day we're talking. Today, I feel pretty good about it. The book has gotten a big reception. It was a New York Times bestseller, which for a book about the media and television, what the book people tell me, that's a really big deal. Those books usually don't reach a wide audience. So I'm like thrilled that readers are seeing that Ailes is a 20th century figure, that he has transformed our politics, that if you want to know about American politics, American conservatism, that he's someone you need to know about. But there were days during the reporting when I really had to work hard to kind of hold my center, because when you have people calling you a bad guy, people calling you an activist, that you're, you know, an unethical person, you know, the day the New York Times review came out, that was really hard for me.
Because
I'm okay with negative reviews. I think, as we were talking earlier, Slate magazine, which is not obviously a conservative magazine, really hammered my book. And I'm used to taking heat. In fact, I like heat because I like controversy. I like debate. That's really one of the reasons I got into this business. But the New York Times review, which was written by Janet Maslin, one of their in-house book critics, she marshaled a lot of misleading statements and actual factual mistakes to paint a picture of me which was totally in line with what the right wing was trying to do, which was to call me unethical, to call me a shady reporter. And she used a word in her review. She called my book disingenuous. And that really bothered me because, you know, people can criticize me a lot, but the one thing that I really hold dear as a reporter is that I'm totally straightforward with my sources and my subjects. I take being above board like the most important bedrock principle of reporting. And so to read that in the New York Times was really troublesome and upsetting. And then to find out that the book reviewer, Janet Maslin, is a close personal friend of a character in my book, made me wonder, well, what are the standards for book reviewers? You know, should she have disclosed that in her review? And it was really interesting that last weekend, the New York Times public editor, Margaret Sullivan, wrote an entire column in the New York Times addressing that very issue. And I was very pleased to read that she essentially weighed in to say that Janet Maslin should have disclosed that her close personal friend Peter Boyer works for Roger Ailes, and that if she's going to write a review about a book about a character, a friend that's a character in the book, that she should have disclosed that. So that was a way where I felt like at least now readers know the full context.
Okay. Well, for an old reporter like me, it's a little bit heartening to see if there's someone else who's willing to go down the same path of being harassed and live with the idea that no good deed goes unpunished.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features investigative journalist Gabriel Sherman, whose new book is The Loudest Voice in the Room, the inside story of how Roger Ailes and Fox News remade American politics. He's joined in conversation by Lowell Bergman. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
We want to open it up for questions.
Yeah, I don't want to offend you, but I think you missed the whole genius of Roger Ailes, mm-hmm. which is, especially Bill O'Reilly, which is news is entertainment. Mm-hmm. And I count myself a liberal Democrat. I think only once voted for a Republican, but I watch him because O'Reilly, one of the things is he can be obnoxious, mm-hmm. he interrupts, he can overtalk, but he always seems to, they have Juan Williams, the other thing, and Barb Bickel, and he usually has two sides. And he's got an Irish twinkle in his eye, but that, I think, is a genius, and you didn't seem to mention that.
Oh, well, we can talk about it now, because you're totally right. Show business flair is Ailes's, one of his talents as a producer, and in fact, he got his start in television, which I write about in depth. It's a major section of the book on the Mike Douglas Show, which was kind of a very middle-of-the-road conservative daytime TV show in the 1960s. Hosted by a former big band singer, Mike Douglas. And Ailes started as a $68 a week prop boy, and within several years had a palace coup, took over the show as the 27-year-old executive producer. And on the set of the Mike Douglas Show, he met all the entertainers of the day, Barbara Streisand, Bill Cosby, political figures like Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King. It was kind of this melting pot of the American mid-1960s culture. And he learned... and his colleagues, all of whom I interviewed, that Ailes soaked up how television can connect with the viewer on an emotional level. TV is about emotion. And the one thing about the Mike Douglas Show that differentiated it from the Johnny Carson Show and all the other show business programs of the time was that it was kind of a zany, earnest, it didn't have any irony. It was a very middle-of-the-road show. And the producers produced every segment to have what they called a payoff. They needed to have a prank, a gag, some kind of trick to make the audience stay hooked and tuned in. And if you watch Fox News, you see that same style of programming. Every segment, someone's going to say something crazy. There's going to be a guest you don't expect. It has that element of drama and surprise that is much different than MSNBC or CNN. Which is a testament to Ailes' producing talents. And the other thing I write about in depth in the book that gets to your point about entertainment and show business is that in the 1970s, after Ailes had worked on the 68 Nixon campaign, he hadn't kind of committed himself to politics. He was a young guy. He's like, well, what else do I want to do in my career? And he moved to Manhattan, and he tried to make it as a Broadway producer. And he produced musicals, plays, cabaret shows. And so you see that theatricality on Fox. And actually, Ailes has said in interviews in recent years that he created the show The Five, which is an afternoon show, as an ensemble show because he always wanted to produce an ensemble play. And his Broadway career didn't work out for him. But he's kind of continuing that theatrical flair that he had from the 60s and 70s now in the news business. And I totally agree. I think news as entertainment is one of Ailes' lasting legacies.
Yeah. Why was Ailes so adamant about not talking to you? What, did he have some feeling about your background or your politics? And also, didn't he talk to the guy that wrote the other book about him?
Mm-hmm. Yes, great question. I think Ailes did not want to talk to me precisely because I wasn't willing to submit to any of his efforts to control who I could talk to, what conclusions I could come to in the book. He couldn't control me is the essence of it. And Ailes, the one thing you need to know about Roger Ailes...
But the critics have said that you're just part of basically the liberal democratic critique of Fox News, and that's your mind was already made up. Mm-hmm.
Exactly the opposite. I mean, from my perspective, it was the exact opposite. My mind was completely open. I wanted, in fact, my conclusion is very different than what I started out with. I started out thinking that Ailes was, as you mentioned, just a TV executive, that this is a great media story. He was the most powerful television news executive of his generation. This was going to be a media book. The book was actually supposed to be a history of Fox News. When I pitched it to Random House, I was going to write kind of a soup to nuts history from 1996 to the present of how Fox News became this, you know, multi-billion dollar business. And it was only through the reporting that I came to this conclusion that Ailes is the kind of the Citizen Kane of his time, that he has used the news business to steer America further to the right, that Fox News is a political organization that happens to employ several journalists. But that conclusion was only reached after the hundreds of interviews I had done, and kind of looking at the reporting and seeing where the reporting took me. But to your point about that other book, so after I had been at work for a year, Ailes knew I was trying to talk to everyone. He went out and teamed up with a writer, Zev Chaffetz, who had written a glowing biography of Rush Limbaugh, who essentially wrote a sanitized version of Ailes' career. It was a quickie book. There was almost no sourcing notes in the back. He talked to several, you know, hand-picked people that Ailes wanted him to talk to. And it was a very revealing book. There was a lot in ways that Ailes didn't probably intend, because I had gone out and talked to everyone. I had read documents. I had been to archives. And I would compare it to the version that Ailes told in this book. And it was almost like a funhouse mirror. It was essentially like watching the news on Fox and comparing it to the way the rest of the media is covering a story. There was almost no through line. It was like the lines did not cross. And so I think it's a testament to Ailes' desire to control narrative. He controlled the image of his Republican clients in the 70s and 80s, George H.W. Bush, Mitch McConnell, Phil Graham, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan. He used media to control their image. So it would make sense that the most important image he would want to control is his own.
I can't help but feel that... that this man is very powerful, and what does that say about us as Americans, as a nation? Mm-hmm. How do we allow such power to exist?
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought a lot about that question, and what I came to see this book as is that it's not a book about television or politics. It's a book about a man, and it's a book about our country, because as your question indicates, it does say a lot about who we are as a people. And I came to one of these conclusions when I was in the Nixon archive, the presidential archives in California, reading these old strategy memos that Ailes, as a 27-year-old, was writing as a young consultant to the Nixon campaign. And he was basically telling Nixon how to use television to sell himself to the American people. And he would say things in these memos like, "People are lazy. TV does the thinking for you. People don't have time to process complicated ideas." TV is another line he used, is TV is a hit-and-run medium. And it's a very cynical view of what human nature is and what American people want, but I feel it's a very honest view. So in that way, I think understanding Ailes' power is understanding a lot about how millions of people think about the world. They want news that confirms their worldview. They don't want to be challenged. They want to be entertained. They want simple storylines. It's very easy to have someone tell you that Barack Obama is the most radical president we've ever had, that he's a socialist trying to transform America, when in fact, you know, deficits are shrinking, Barack Obama is using robots to kill people all over the world. I mean, he's a very conservative when it comes to foreign policy. In many ways, George Bush passed the TARP bailout bill. You know, government spending was growing under Bush. So you can look at the facts, completely contradicts the narrative that you see on Fox that he's not a Marxist socialist. But it's easy to say that, and people want that. If that's your opinion of politics and the president, then that news channel, that voice is going to speak to you. And I think that's because Ailes understands that's what people want. And one last point I want to make is that when Ailes started Fox in 1996, there was a saying that all of his top executives used. People don't want to be informed. They want to feel informed. So Fox News was a channel that I argue in the book is a political organization, but it's an organization that is created to make people feel like they're watching the news, but what they're getting actually is both entertainment and political messages that advance Roger Ailes' agenda.
Thank you for a really interesting read. My mind was already made up about Fox News, but now I know why.
Well, at least you finished it. I kept you going, so.
But the one thing that I had hoped to learn more about was the kind of complex relationship between Rupert Murdoch and Roger Ailes, and who was really in charge here?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. I do explore it in the book because, and I'll talk more about it because it is a fascinating relationship. Lowell has covered Murdoch. He knows that Murdoch uses his media, his newspapers all over the world to advance his agenda. Fox News really delivered on a dream that Rupert Murdoch had, which was to have a national voice in American politics. Rupert Murdoch came to America in the late 70s, started buying newspapers, TV stations, but he lacked a national voice. And what he learned is that America, because of our sprawl, we're a car culture, we're not a newspaper culture, we don't commute on trains the way they do in London and in Australia, that TV was the way to reach the masses. And all through the 80s and early 90s, Murdoch failed to create a viable TV news outlet. He tried several news magazines. He wanted to create sort of a conservative version of 60 Minutes that never really went anywhere. So in 1996, when he hired Roger Ailes, he wanted Ailes to create a cable news channel that would take down CNN. It would be more populist and tabloid. Essentially, the original blueprint for Fox News was like the New York Post with pictures. It wasn't originally going to be a right-wing megaphone. It grew into that, which is a reflection of Ailes' power. But to Ailes' relationship with Murdoch, it's not particularly close. They are not close friends. It's a business relationship. It's essentially a relationship of convenience. Each man gives the other what the other person needs. What Rupert Murdoch gives Ailes is capital and essentially a free rein to program Fox News as he sees fit. What Ailes gives Murdoch is profit. Fox News is the single most profitable division of Rupert Murdoch's media empire. It is responsible for something on the order of 30% of now 21st Century Fox Group's profits. They split the company after the phone hacking scandal. So Fox News allows Rupert Murdoch to publish newspapers, to dabble in all these other ventures that lose money because of the reliable profits. And a reflection, an example of Ailes' power is that through the years, Ailes has feuded with Murdoch's children. And each time Ailes has gone to Murdoch to speak up, to basically say, you got to choose your children or me, Murdoch blinked and chose Ailes. So that tells you a lot if you're willing to put Roger Ailes, your corporate executive, ahead of your own blood.
I feel like a lot of people my age would say that Fox News is kind of a propaganda machine, but we are obviously not professionals, and you two are, so you would use that word professionally, so I wonder how that would fit. So please comment. Thank you.
Ailes, from his earliest days in television, was captivated by that word. On the set of the Mike Douglas show in 1967, or early 68, late 67, because he met Nixon in January 68. He told a colleague, a producer who I interviewed on the record, Ailes recounted how captivated he was by the films of Leni Riefenstahl, the Nazi filmmaker and propagandist, not for any of the ideology, but for her use of camera angles, lighting, staging to advance a political message. He's very cognizant. Ailes speaks about the power of image to transmit a message. And so, while I don't use the word propaganda very often throughout the book, because I find it such a loaded word that I'd rather let the reporting show that, let the narrative help you come to that conclusion. But without a doubt, Ailes sees television as a way to advance politics, which is essentially the classic definition of propaganda.
You know, one thing to keep in mind is that electronic media at one time was regulated, and it had to operate within certain strictures. And I mentioned it earlier: the right of reply, the fairness doctrine. All of that emanated from a fear that it would be used for propaganda purposes, and there are Supreme Court decisions related to it as well. It's the dissolution of that kind of regulation that makes it very difficult to maintain the idea that news should have, for example, some standards.
Mm-hmm. That's a good segue to my question, which is, have you been interviewed by Fox News yet, or do you think there's a chance? I mean, I'd love to see you on O'Reilly, probably even more than Jon Stewart.
So the answer is no, but there's two points I want to clarify because I think it's so revealing. Number one, Howie Kurtz, who for many years hosted a media ethics show on CNN, essentially flamed out of CNN in his own media ethics scandal of his own. It's kind of ironic. And who hires him is Roger Ailes. So Howie Kurtz now hosts a media ethics show on Fox. And the week my book was out, he announced on air on Fox that they were going to talk about it. They were going to, you know, do a segment. You know, next week we're going to do a segment about Gabe Sherman's book. Well, next week comes along, and it's silence, crickets. So somebody, this is a reporter's question that when I have time, I want to dig into. I want to find who got to Howie Kurtz and scuttled that segment to talk about my book. So I have not been on Fox. They have not talked about my book. And when I first started the project, I said to one of Ailes' advisors, I said, I would come on the channel, and it can be 8-on-1. You can put me in a round table, and I'll face Hannity, O'Reilly, this Glenn Beck was still there at the time. I'd love to face them all, so maybe someday it will happen.
Thanks to all of you for coming. Thanks to Lowell Bergman and to you, Gabe Sherman. Have a great
evening.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was really great. Thank you so much.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was investigative journalist Gabriel Sherman, whose new book is The Loudest Voice in the Room, the inside story of how Roger Ailes and Fox News remade American politics. He was joined in conversation by Lowell Bergman. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Tuttle, and Chris Howell. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I invite you to tune in again next Thursday at noon when Bina will feature television anchor and journalist Jane Pauley. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.